The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
People in the alternative media call, well, others call it too, but we tend to hear it a lot, the Hegelian dialectic. And they say, okay, this is how we are being manipulated. We're being manipulated with a solution that's presented to us, a solution that is decided for us, then a problem is created and a reaction is controlled and we get to the solution. Now, as I've read about that, I understand to some extent the problem reaction solution, but in my reading about Hegel, I think that the evil side of this has been blamed on Hegel, when really this is not what Hegel was trying to get to. And I'm understanding, and I'll turn it over to you, Matthew, when I've kind of cleared my head here, I'm understanding that Hegel saw the problem reaction solution as a diagnostic view of the world and how things operate, whereas the elite tend to use it against us in a way to manipulate us. Am I right or am I wrong?
Okay, if you have 6 or 7 hours, I could answer that. I don't even know where to start. When I was in graduate school, I spent a huge amount of time on George William Frederick Hegel and his epistemology. Hegel, as you probably know, is by far the most difficult writer to read. Most people, including professional philosophers, simply have given up because they have no idea what he's talking about, partially because he has his own vocabulary, partially because his method of argumentation was extremely difficult to follow, and on top of it all, he was very long-winded. Now, I did my master's thesis on Hegel's Philosophy of Right, which was his last book, strictly on political theory. But then I did my dissertation on Michael Oakeshott. Michael Oakeshott was an English idealist who was a follower of Hegel to some extent and died in 1991. So I have some understanding of how to approach this, but I want to stress that you just don't go into a library and take Hegel's two-volume Logic or his Phenomenology of Spirit and start reading it. You know, you'll just end up burning it because you won't have any clue what's happening. Mm. And I know that there are people who are kind of on our side politically who mention the Hegelian dialectic without, first of all, having a clue of who Hegel was, and number two, not having a clue what dialectics are. But you're the first guy who's in mentioning Hegel at all in a political context has begun to realize that what's happened to Hegel's general epistemological method has absolutely nothing to do with what Hegel supported. Politically speaking, he was extremely conservative, and I'm going to tell you, the Philosophy of Right, if you can get through it, is one of the best, most brilliant works of political philosophy that I've ever come across. And back in the early 90s, I really became very much a Hegelian. So that's the really brief answer, that yes, you're correct, but I want to go further than that.
Please do.
The thesis-antithesis distinction is not something that Hegel talks about very much. The concept of the creation of a synthesis, this isn't something that Hegel talks about very much. I want to, because I've read both volumes of The Logic, his encyclopedia, as well as Phenomenology of Spirit and the Philosophy of Right. Even the Phenomenology of Spirit, I spent, in 1996, I spent all of February of that year on the first 40 pages of that 800-page book. But that's really the only way to read it, because even there, there's more questions that come up than it answers. But that's just his style. Now, let me reduce this And I'm going to give you the most simple and simplistic version of this I could possibly muster. And in so doing, I'm going to give you two propositions concerning as to what the dialectical method is in Hegel, not in Hess, not in Marx, not in Feuerbach, in Hegel. Number one, there is no such thing as our direct perception of any object in space and time. There is no direct perception between your senses and this object, whatever you happen to be looking at the moment. That does not exist. Everything that you do, everything that you look at and you hear or you sense in one way or another is being filtered by a whole set of historically conditioned concepts. That when you look at something, you're looking at it with many different lenses between you and the object. And these lenses have to do with the political situation and economic situation that you happen to live under in this particular point in history. That's number one. There is no such thing as objects floating around in space and time. We filter them. Objects change us as much as we comprehend objects. The second proposition is that there is no such thing in how we look at the world around us. There is no such thing as an individual. An individual is, in Hegel's term, is abstract. The word abstract, like everything in Hegel, doesn't mean what we normally mean. Abstract means, nothing means what it normally means. That's the problem with trying to read this guy. The word abstract means not a real individual. A real individual is that which is cognized only through itself, by itself. The only thing that could satisfy that criterion is the whole, the absolute. What we're looking at, when we look at an individual, we are, not only are we looking at this filtered through our concepts that we're born and raised with, but we're looking at it in a myriad of relations with everything surrounding it. When you look at an object in nature and you call a tree an individual, it is an abstract statement. In other words, it's only partially true because a tree or a rock or a human being is something that has been created by so many different other objects coming together in a context, in a set of relationships, and an individual is only one little piece of that. So those two propositions, that's the radically fourth grade level understanding of what Hegel is talking about in his two-volume Logic.
Wow. Okay, so now let me hop around a little bit, and given our limited time, we'll stay with trying to understand how this dialectic term, Hegelian dialectic, is applied to us indirectly and what's happened. So I'm reading that Hegel was a conservative. Hegel was not Jewish, was he?
No, absolutely not. I think he was hostile to Jews in general.
Okay, so what was it that Marx saw, and was Marx able to accurately decode Hegel? How was it that Marx adapted what Hegel is saying here?
Well, there's more than one step. If Hegel and Marx ever met each other, Hegel would condemn Karl Marx with no hesitation.
Now, isn't that interesting? That's not what you hear. That's okay. Go ahead.
Well, again, I mean, there's like 10 people in the world who have ever been able to get through the phenomenology and kind of get what's going on. I'm not one of them. But I think I have a halfway decent grasp on what's happening. Hegel believed in the primacy of thought and logic. Spirit came first. For Karl Marx, there was no spirit. Karl Marx, for the most part, received his philosophical point of view from Ludwig Feuerbach, who wrote a book called The Essence of Christianity, where he held that our spiritual concepts are the result of our alienation. Given the perverted nature of the world that we live in, we have projected our needs and desires for wholeness and fulfillment and created this whole spiritual realm of God and angels and saints and the church and everything else. That's where Marx takes his start. Hegel was simply used by Marx And the method of the dialectic that Marx took was something that was and Moses Hess, even more than Marx, that social classes and political movements, the relation between the individual and society, the state and the world, all this kind of thing, can be understood through this constant clash of opposites. And in any given moment, these opposites existed in some kind of equilibrium. For Marx, technology and the development of science is what's going to tip this equilibrium into a revolutionary situation, both in terms of the development of capitalism from feudalism and eventually the development of socialism from capitalism. So I want to say that between Hegel and Marx, you have absolutely not very little in common. You don't even have the method in common. And ultimately, Hegel's final thought is you have to understand the whole of natural philosophy before you can understand any piece of it. And that's what makes him so difficult.
So I'm reading from your two precepts, I guess you called them, or earlier on. Hegel was saying no such thing as a pure individual. The real individual is abstract. Ultimately, Hegel is saying God is the only real individual, is he not?
Sort of. But by abstract, what Hegel means is something that's only partially true. So, for example, if I claim that I am an individual and I am therefore independent of anything that's happening around me, Hegel will say, well, that's true only in a very limited way, because your whole vocabulary concerning rights and the family and the tradition that you're raised in and the society, all the economic issues and everything else, that helped create that very same person, that same ego that you're saying is completely independent. So you automatically have a contradiction. You can't go around claiming that I am a sovereign individual when, in fact, that very concept of the sovereign individual predates you and is something that has philosophically been formulated, and that's the context in which you were born and raised. Had you been born 1,000 years ago, you wouldn't even have been talking in those terms. Mm-hmm. So the very action of you claiming that you are a sovereign individual contains in and of itself a contradiction. So do you understand what I'm trying to say here? It's abstract in the sense that it's only partially true.
Yes.
It would be completely true if you were to then embed yourself in these institutions and the different points of view that have developed in Western society over the last few hundred years, and then you realize that you're a product of those intellectual movements. So that's what he means. That would be coming closer to the truth than the simple statement that you are this sovereign individual. That doesn't just occur for people. That occurs for anything that we may look at in nature. Any natural object is the same way. A tree can't exist without oxygen. It can't exist without carbon dioxide. It can't exist without the soil. It can't exist without water. So to talk about a tree completely separate from all of these other things is to be crazy.
Yeah.
A tree is only a part of a much broader context. So if you were to point to a tree and say, that's a thing, that's an object, Hegel says that in and of itself contains, the very act of you saying that contains an inherent contradiction.
I think the little light is turning on, Matthew. I think I'm beginning to understand what you're saying. And forgive me, it's 6 in the morning and the wheels are slowly starting to roll. I'm going to redirect us just a little bit, because we'll come back to who Hegel was and so on. I would like, though, to ask, I have read, and only on the internet and not in hard copy at this moment, that Moses Hess, who you mentioned, who's always been a character of interest to me, more so probably than Marx, that Moses Hess was influenced by Hegel. Would you agree with that, or do you think is it a long bow?
No, I would say the same thing that I said about Marx. I'll say that they both took a handful of things from here. You got to remember, the middle of the 19th century, if you were a philosopher, you knew Hegel very well. He was the man. He was by far the most dominant figure philosophically speaking, long after his death. So everybody was influenced by Hegel. So in and of itself, that doesn't mean anything. Hegel was not a materialist. Moses Heston, Karl Marx, and Ludwig Feuerbach, those are the big three in the middle of the 19th century, they are materialists 100%. So their use of Hegel really just is in the use of what became this stylized and formulaic thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and that, you know, it that's a perversion of Hegel.
Okay. Now, getting on to that, while it's a perversion of Hegel, I'd like to read to you a quote that I've used, and as I've used this quote, I understand what the writer is saying, and then as I read, this is Nikki Rapana, and as I read her work, I thought I better find out before I sound like either like an idiot or like somebody in the alternative movement with a bullhorn shouting at a building. I better be sure that I understand. And that's where I began to realize that Hegel had been misrepresented, what little I could read about him. But Nikki Rapana writes about the use of the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and she uses, and here's a very interesting quote, let me read it to you. "The logic of dialectical philosophy has remained above the reach of the common man since the beginning of recorded human history. There are two levels of dialectical reasoning. The elite, top students, teachers, and practitioners completely understand the final synthesis of dialectical ideologies. Lower level philosophical education does not include the synthesis. This omission is the defining line between freedom and slavery. Modern public education, which excludes the synthesis, furthers the separation of citizens into classes." That's a mouthful, but to me it's a very telling and very powerful analysis of how people are led. Have you heard that statement before, or did I email it to you earlier on?
You may have. I've heard various versions of that thesis for the last, 20 years of that type of statement over the last two decades. So, no, it's not all that uncommon. Although I would say that in making that statement, the person never read Hegel, but she may be absolutely, it is a she, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She may be absolutely correct insofar as other people who came after him. She is correct to say that dialectics has been in existence since the dawn of humanity, because Socrates made it clear that what he did was use the dialectical form. That simply means that I can only convince my students that I'm telling the truth if my point of view and my opponent's point of view clash, and we could come to some kind of common ground over time, and I could use that negative that negative argumentation in fact constructing my own argument. So that's what Socrates was doing. Hegel most certainly didn't believe in any kind of elitist mentality. He didn't believe in any of that at all. In fact, when you read the philosophy of Right, he was very much a nationalist and a syndicalist, because he was very much afraid that the free market was going to get out of control, that the free market would produce such inequality and poverty that he posited what he calls the corporation. The corporation is something that a lot of nationalists have taken as economically important without realizing its source. A corporation is essentially a craft guild or union that would take workers in a specific area and organize them. And then when he posited, he believed in a two-chamber legislature, that these guilds, so to speak, would be represented in the upper house. So I think that Hegel was very, very concerned with what unrestrained capitalism can produce in terms of inequality, and posited the corporation as something that would help justify and form a truly moral and organic state. And even there, when Hegel uses the word state, He doesn't use it in the same way that me and you normally use it. He has a totally different thing. It's actually somewhat of a common early 19th century German concept of state. State for Hegel didn't just mean the army and bureaucracy. It meant all of the ethnic and linguistic and cultural traditions of a people that come to justify any law that happens to be passed by the legislature. In other words, it's legitimate only if we as citizens can see ourselves in its promulgation. So Hegel's politics is, I think, immensely profound. And now the philosophy of right is easier to read than the phenomenology, but unless you know his vocabulary, don't even try.
Amazing. And Hegel himself was not attempting to obscure what he was saying. He's not like a Talmudist just trying to hide his opinion behind nuance only for the elect. He has had to form a vocabulary to relay his concepts. Am I correct there?
I would say that. I think that, like a lot of people, he was afraid that a lot of what he was saying would be vulgarized. And he certainly was right about that. This is why Christ didn't write anything down. This is why Socrates didn't write anything down. They were afraid that the transmission would be distorted. If you write something down and on paper, it can be twisted in any number of ways. And I think his style was just very, very obscure, largely because he's synthesizing a whole lot of very difficult people. He's synthesizing Plato and Aristotle. He's synthesizing Kant and Fichte. And all of those guys, in and of themselves, are fairly difficult. Trying to bring them all together in one large synthetic system, I think, was very, very hard. And that's why when people do Hegel, they study Hegel. It's like, you know, you got to go and live in a cave for 5 years and just concentrate, because you really have to absorb so much at the same time and keep it all straight, and that's a heck of a lot of work.
If I was going to live in a cave for 5 years to absorb something, it would be the Bible. I would have to think that Hegel would be somewhere down the list, at least in myself. But,
no, I agree. I'm simply saying that, and this really is kind of a sustained critique of a lot of people, the talking heads, people who are writing out there on our side, who, you know, they drop these names like Plato and Hegel, and they don't have a clue as to what they're talking about. They heard a rumor somewhere, and this is what they're repeating. I'm saying that if you want to understand these people, it's a full-time job.
And I agree. And that's why I so much appreciate your input in this, and trying to help me as a rank amateur with an analytical mind to get to the core of that. Now, nevertheless, the problem reaction solution, or the pre-planned solution and the problem reaction, that has been used against free people, has it not? I'm not saying Hegel's view, but let's now step a little bit back from Hegel and say this concept of I have a solution. Maybe I'll give you an example here. My solution is that I want to break Iraq into three, give Israel control over the north, and convert the oil contracts to PSAs, to profit-sharing agreements. This is Iraq. This is what our solution is. We don't tell anybody. We don't tell the slave class. So the problem is Saddam is bad. Saddam killed babies in incubators. Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Saddam doesn't cut his nose hair. You know, whatever.
Right.
And the reaction is Operation Desert Storm, Operation Desert Shield, Operation Iraqi Freedom. So we see the we're presented with a problem. We have a reaction. All we do is those Iraqis are bad. And the solution is what we have today. Iraq is breaking into three. Israel has control over the north. The oil contracts are being converted to PSAs. That process has been used to the detriment of humanity.
You're absolutely correct, and I'll give a far simpler example, and that's the two-party system. No matter who you elect, you're getting the same ideology seen from two points of view. The ends of these people are precisely the same. The means that the two parties, your liberals and conservatives, would use to get to the ends are different, but the ends are exactly the same. So it doesn't make any difference who you elect. Now, I don't think politicians have very much power. I think bureaucrats and judges and bankers have power. But that's just an example. Now, I want to say that when you talk about the perversion of the dialectic, the way that you have just described it, you're referring to an old occult doctrine that good and evil are the same thing, darkness and light are the same thing, truth and falsehood are the same thing, and we can't judge between them. That's, you know, you see it in the yin yang symbol, you see it in the two pillars of Joachim and Boaz of the temple, you see it in all of these dualistic occult doctrines, that good and evil are just words, they're just labels. We're really talking about the same reality seen from two different points of view. That's not what Hegel's saying. Hegel is simply saying that when we look at our external world, we can't take one part of it and isolate it from everything else.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com.
Well, energizing relations and boosting trade. That's what the leaders of Russia and China have been discussing right here in Moscow. Negotiating a 30-year gas deal is the next stop on the Chinese leaders' trip to the capital. RT's Peter Oliver is monitoring the talks. And Peter, there's been a lot of back and forth between Moscow and Beijing over this. But tell us, what is so big about the anticipated gas agreement?
Well, this is a potentially huge deal, and we're currently in the final furlong, as it were, of agreeing this deal that would see Russia provide gas to China for the next 30 years. Now, this is a hugely mutual beneficial deal for both sides. Now, Russia will receive billions of dollars in revenue from providing the Chinese with energy, and the Chinese will, of course, receive the fuel they need to continue their economic growth. Now, the last little stumbling block has been coming up with the price. Now, Russia say they want to have they want to charge the same price as they charge to provide Europe with gas, which is $306 per 1,000 cubic meters. The Chinese are asking for a bit of a discount on that. And currently, just behind me in Gazprom headquarters, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and representatives from Gazprom are currently trying to hammer out a deal with President Hu Jintao of China and representatives from the Chinese energy provider. Now, it just seems that whether you're buying a used car or negotiating the final point of a multi-billion dollar gas agreement, both sides always going to want the best deal for themselves. So, of course, Russia are wanting the best price for the gas they're providing, and China are wanting the gas they need so badly to fuel their economic growth for the price they want to pay. So whether a deal is done this evening at Gazprom headquarters, or it's done at the Economic Forum in St. Petersburg, which is coming up shortly, it is about to get done. Now, President Hu Jintao has said that this gas deal, natural gas, is an important component of Russia-China relations. So there's no underestimating how important this is to both sides. And as I say, that price, as always, just seems to be the final thing that needs to be ironed out.
Well, as you say, you know, there are certainly some important issues to iron out for this big deal to go through, Peter. But, you know, certainly we're seeing a very friendly meeting between the Chinese leader Hu Jintao and his Russian counterparts. But the Chinese leader, he met Russia's president this afternoon. They had a lot of talks behind closed doors. What details do you know of?
Well, they signed some major trade agreements earlier on today. They currently trade between Russia and China at an all-time high, and that seems like it's only going to get larger. They signed an agreement that by 2015, trade between the two nations will be worth $100 billion, and by 2020, less than 10 years away, it'll be worth $200 billion. So good news for people wanting to export and import between those two nations. There's going to be a huge increase in commerce between Russia and China. Now, it wasn't just business.
Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Let me give you another example. The guy that I did my doctoral dissertation on, Michael Oakeshott, his doctoral dissertation, done in the 1930s, was called Experience and Its Modes. The point was that whenever an individual looks at the external world, they are using the concepts to interpret that world that they have been raised in. So, for example, if I'm a scientist and I've been trained at the university level and I look at the natural world outside of me, such a person will see everything as quantity. They'll see everything as biological or chemical relations. And that's fair enough. When a poet or a religious person looks at the exact same thing, he is not going to see the biological or chemical realities. They'll see symbols. They'll see God's presence. They'll see this integrated whole. When a businessman looks at the exact same thing, the businessman will see, oh, I should chop these trees down and make money out of it. You know what I'm saying? Yes. Everybody looking at the exact same object, given the set of concepts that they've been raised in and trained in, is going to see different things. The final problem is, the real sin here, is when one group, let's say science, claims that its point of view is the only point of view. Mm-hmm. Or the businessman saying only dollars and cents, pure quantity, that's the only thing that matters. That is the nature of reality. So what people like Oakeshott and to some extent Hegel are saying is that when you look at an object, you're not really looking at an object. You are looking at a set of concepts that you're using to interpret that object. That's at the core of what we're talking about here.
So, ladies and gentlemen, my guest today is Father Matthew Raphael Johnson. We're discussing the dialectic, the Hegelian dialectic, and how we view the world. And we have just really got to the crux of the matter. Now, I'm going to try to step back, Matthew, and if I've missed this or got it wrong, you can correct me. What we have now in the world in which we live is that correct me if I'm wrong, all our views about any particular thing we see, I'm looking out at my lemon tree. So the evolutionist view of the lemon tree is the one that everybody has. This came from, I don't know, a mushroom or whatever they want it to be. and I'm only allowed one view of this. When I look at money, I'm only really allowed one view. So in time, our perception has been unified by an elite view that probably is money first, religion, philosophy second, and maybe in that order, I'm not sure. So I'm going to hand it back to you. Have I got that right, Matthew, or am I missing it?
No, I think you're grasping it. In other words, what Hegel is saying, and to even the British idealists like T.H. Green or Bernard Bosanquet, Michael Oakeshott, what these guys are saying is that a power elite can substitute their set of concepts and impose that on everybody through the education, media systems, and everything else. And you mentioned evolution, the complete domination of science in that particular point of view is that set of concepts that most of us are supposed to use in looking at the outside world, including our own personhood.
Yes.
And that's what Michael Oakeshott is saying, that this is the sin of the modern world, is that one particular mode of experience is thrusting itself on everybody else as the only mode of experience, and we know that it isn't the only mode of experience.
So really, if I'm applying Hegel correctly, as opposed to how so many alternative and armchair philosophers apply him, if I'm applying Hegel correctly, I absolutely do not see an apple the same way as the next guy sees an apple. Or I do not see money as the next. I am really compelled to see it differently.
And that depends on which particular point in history you happen to live in.
Uh-huh. That's true. Yes.
So if we were born 1,000 years ago, we wouldn't look at the natural world in the same way. Hegel was vehemently, violently opposed to the Illuminati, and he mentions them in his attack on the French Revolution. He condemns the French Revolution and the concept of revolutionary politics because he sees in the French Revolution, he sees a little bit of truth, but a mountain of error. And that mountain of error is reducible to the concept that the individual, or in that case, the elite individual, was setting himself up as the supreme ruler of everything political and religious and poetic and literary and everything else. That was the problem. That's not how society is. When the individual tries to throw off history, remember, I mean, the French revolutionaries rewrote the calendar. They started at year one. You know, yes. When you throw out history and tradition and all of these things that helped make us what we are, it automatically will eventually lead to the terror. All revolutions will be bloody because one class of people is setting themselves up as the arbiter of all experience. Everything is political. Everything is dominated by us. This is what he condemns when he writes in the Philosophy of Right, as well as in other places, in the French Revolution. So that should tell you a lot about how he viewed politics in the state and revolutionary governments. And this is why Karl Marx, while taking the dialectic and using it, condemned Hegel. He wrote a book condemning George William Frederick Hegel. And this is some of the reason, because Hegel in Marx's mind was this fuddy-duddy monarchist and Prussian bureaucrat, as he called him, and we can't take him seriously. So that's the key here.
Now, if I come back to problem reaction solution, or as it's forced upon us, it's a hidden solution, a problem and reaction. And I might be changing direction ever so slightly. Do you see that as being a Talmudic in origin? Do you see the influence or the use of that against people as being like the conversations that the rabbis have in the Talmud?
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely, positively. The Talmud is the most evil set of books, I think, that have ever been written. And that's the mentality that me and you have dedicated our lives to condemning. That has nothing to do with the Hegelian point of view.
So really, for want of a better phrase, all of the alternative media types should really be saying is, rather than this is the Hegelian dialectic, it's the Talmudic dialectic that we're really talking about.
Right. I would use that phrase. I would use Talmudic. I would use occult. I would use whatever it is. But to drag Hegel, of all people, into this is really just a tremendous amount of ignorance, especially because the left, after Hegel, you know, Hegel dies in 1831. You know, it's, you know, he's a fairly early figure in the contemporary era. You know, the left really condemned Hegel because his philosophy of right is almost a manifesto of sort of a traditionalist Prussian nationalism, and it only very rarely gets read like that anymore. I think the Philosophy of Right is one of the greatest works of political theory ever put together.
Interesting. Well, this is the common tactic of the left and probably a little bit of the right too now, as it's become more left. But that is to scapegoat a thinker or scapegoat a concept. In the general case, Christians today are scapegoated for pretty much all of the evils in the world. And so I could see that maybe accidentally Hegel has been scapegoated, or maybe intentionally. Maybe look, we're using a Talmudic approach to control the world, but we're going to blame it on this German Christian philosopher.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And although I could understand how they could mistake the dialectic the way that people like Marx understood it for something that Hegel said, because I see the occult black is white, white is black equivalence of light and darkness. I see it everywhere. And with people like Michael Hoffman, who first taught me through his writings about the central concept of the occult, that God and the devil really are brothers who just look at the world in two very different ways.
Yeah.
when I first watched Harry Potter, the first thing that struck me was that Harry Potter and Voldemort are the same person. That's the secret understanding of that set of movies. Light is dark and dark is light. They're the same person. And I'm seeing that. I'm seeing it all over the place. But I don't want to make any of that contingent on at least what Hegel thought he was doing.
No, and that's excellent. But now, so let's drift away now to this occult view of the world. Several years ago, I wrote an interesting article, and it was about David's sin. And that's King David's sin. Now, we would understand it pretty much, I would anyways, at face value. So here is a king who's basically a good man, but his sense of judgment under pressure is not good. He sees a beautiful woman. He has an affair. He arranges the death of her husband, for which he pays a horrible price. So that's my face value reading. I mean, that's a lifetime of a king in two sentences, okay? But the Talmudic view of this is that since David was righteous, he could do no wrong. Therefore, King David actually didn't sin by having the affair with Bathsheba, because when a man is at war, he's considered divorced, so his wife is fair game. He really sinned in how he communicated this to the populace. Have you read that?
I've absolutely read that, and again, thank you to Michael Hoffman, who in his Judaism Discovered uncovers all of this complete and total nullification of the Old Testament. And the theory is, as it developed in the Talmud, that the Jewish male cannot sin. This is why in the Talmud, and I've actually had to send the snippets of this to people who didn't believe me, that the prophets, especially the prophet Isaiah, are also, along with Jesus, in hell. Because the whole world of the prophets was to condemn Israel for its lack of faith, for its fraud, for its lying, for its being like all the nations. Every single prophet, without exception, had the same mentality. Therefore, these cannot be taken as legitimate writers of Scripture, and therefore Isaiah, leading the way, because Isaiah was just so, he wrote so much, is in hell, as are all the prophets, because they condemned Israel, and Israel is not condemnable in the Talmudic mentality.
When God is dialoguing with Jeremiah, and Jeremiah, and I think it's 31, and Jeremiah said, what about the city? And God said, the place, the city has vexed me from the day they built it. And speaking of Jerusalem, well now, when I read this and I say this at face value, I don't need to codify this. I don't need to reinterpret this passage to say the city's always given God trouble. A Talmudist, on the other hand, must do something with either the statement or with the messenger. Correct?
Absolutely. It has to be nullified.
Yep.
How could you possibly read someone like Amos, who does nothing but condemn the Israelite women at the time with their money and their arrogance and their pushiness? He sounds like us. He's saying the same kind of things just, you know, thousands of years ago. So either these men have to be condemned to hell, which is normally how they do it, or the whole thing has to be rewritten and nullified. And no matter how often I cite this stuff to these Protestant Zionists, I get nowhere, because they don't care, they don't want to know, and it's just too inconvenient.
Now, one of our broadcasters on the network here is a gentleman named Don Preston, who's a prolific author and scholar, written many books, and he attempted to engage a rabbinical student to debate, particularly based on Jeremiah 3, where it talks about the fact that the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark, there'll be no remembrance of it. It'll be gone forever. And I can't exactly quote it, Jeremiah 3:16, I think it is, that the Ark will be gone, it won't be in memory, etc. anymore. And I've attempted to do this myself. So when they talk about we're going to rebuild the temple, for example, I say, all right, how do you deal with that? Now, they refused to debate him on that. I thought, having heard that, I'm going to try a different approach. So I used an internet forum with a rabbi who was very good. We had a very good back and forth conversation. I understand what he was saying. But when I got to this point and I said, well, tell me what that means, he immediately knew or sensed that I wasn't Jewish. And not that I was obscuring it, but because I could speak the language, if you will, I could understand what they were doing. And he said, you won't understand. And I said, why won't I understand? The passage directly says there will never be a return to the Ark of the Covenant in Jeremiah. Why do you think he said I wouldn't understand? Is it that it was hidden from me, or that I was attempting a direct interpretation of the passage?
I think what he meant, I mean, when a real Orthodox rabbi, in the Talmudic sense, talks with us, first of all, they're not talking to a human being. They're talking to a soulless animal. So what is the point of going to my cat and explaining deep theology to my cat?
I'm sorry, I didn't think about it in those terms. Go ahead.
You know, I've never tried to do this, but that's more or less what the hardcore Talmudic point of view would be. So the point is, and I say this to anyone who will listen, these guys don't give a damn about what we call the Old Testament. They wouldn't care about the Old Testament. It's completely irrelevant. The people who matter are the old rabbinical sages who put the Talmud together. This is the authority. And the citations that people like Hoffman and myself can put together and on this question could fill this room. It's the Old Testament is totally, not only do they not believe it, it's completely irrelevant. Judaism is a political, ethnic, and racial movement for absolute domination over places like the United States. It has nothing to do with theology whatsoever. There's no spirit, there's no God except for the Jews collectively. So the Old Testament and this, you know, the prophets and the Psalms and Proverbs and everything is completely irrelevant. It's just not part of the equation. But for him to explain that to you and try to make it sound coherent, forget it. I would probably, if I were him, I'd probably say the same thing. Oh, you wouldn't get it. I have other things to do. So that's the message.
Yeah, that's interesting. When I first started this program, the first time, first story I told, a friend who's a businessman who was on an airplane sitting next to a rabbinical student, just as it happened, and so my friend is very well spoken and engaged the gentleman in quite a good conversation about whatever. And finally he said, so you, I'm a Christian, said you wouldn't believe in Jesus. Of course, no, you know, the typical smile, nod, no, not another Gentile kind of no, I guess.
Right.
And, you know, and my friend said, how do you understand Daniel's prophecies pointing to the time when he would be born and so on? And the rabbinical student said, oh, excuse me, I need to talk to my friend. Got up, left, found another seat, never came back.
Yeah,
just wouldn't engage him at all.
Right, and it's not that he doesn't have an answer. It's just that to answer you would be going against the Talmud. They can't reveal a lot of this stuff to a non-Jewish, and especially an explicitly Christian audience. And, you know, I grew up in a Jewish area. I am from Union County, New Jersey. And I know the mentality. A lot of my friends growing up were Jews. And this is the basic mentality. This isn't prejudice. This is something that I know very, very well. And I reacted to the Jewish mentality only because I know it very well.
Well, in my own place here, I have in many respects a pity for my Jewish friends. I have many Jewish friends and businessmen and acquaintances and in the business world in a city like this one, because I, like them, have been victims of bad eschatology. And for years when I was a Christian Zionist, I was thinking, and I'm ashamed to say it, Matthew, and Michael always chuckles when he said, Al used to be a Christian Zionist. Well, I was. But I used to see the inconsistencies, and I used to say, how can it be that these two worldviews, which are not a little bit different, that is the Jewish view of the kingdom and the Christian view of the kingdom, how can they have been synthesized, again, back to our synthesis question, how could they have been synthesized into a new religion? And finally, I just had to start asking the right questions.
Right, and that could be painful, because even I, when I, my first couple of years in college, I was very pro-Israel. I was Roman Catholic, which, you know, pretty much is just a synagogue for the Gentiles. And I mean, at least the last few popes. I mean, that's all they want to talk about.
Definitely the last few, that's right.
Yeah, the last few of them. So, you know, the point is, I had to ask those questions, and a lot of my Jewish friends at the time, you know, eventually abandoned me. So I can't say I have Jewish friends anymore. That was a long time ago. And the attacks on, I mean, my father was a funeral director, who had a funeral home in a Gentile funeral home in a Jewish area. Let's say that he got death threats very early on, because to have Gentile corpses in a Jewish area, people had to move out. I mean, you can't have Gentile corpses within a certain area. So, I know this stuff from experience, and I know how much they hate us, and I know what they did in the Soviet Union and how they wildly deny it. And this is the nature of our situation right now. And me and you might disagree on the concept of the end times, but as far as the agency of sin in this world right now, organizationally speaking, I think we're on the same page.
Yes, we are, and we've looked at some of the history of the Soviet Union. That in fact, when after the fall of it, you have Rabbi Weiss saying this was, I'm going to definitely misquote him here, but something like this was one of the greatest accomplishments of the sons and daughters of Israel. And he wasn't talking about the creation of the state of Israel; he was talking about the creation of the Bolshevik state.
I could go back to the 1920s and 30s and come up with Jewish newspaper after Jewish newspaper saying that the Soviet Union is ours, that this is our, these are our people, this is our political system, and back then they didn't make a big deal. I mean, that this was our system. Now, of course, they'll deny it, but you know, the Jews talk to one another in one respect. They talk to us in a totally different respect. They're constantly schizophrenic. And I think this is one of the problems that has led to a Jewish mental illness and a lot of Jewish personal problems in the 20th century, at least in the 20th century.
Yeah. Well, when you come to back to our question of the dialectic and how conversation is maintained and how culture is maintained, you begin to see this Talmudic style influence. So what we're saying is we really want the degradation of the family. Not our families, of course, other families, their families or whatever. So rather than up front say we want to abolish marriage, they may as well say it now, rather than up front say we want everybody to experiment with homosexuality, though soon they might even make it compulsory if they'd have their way.
Right.
What happens is you have this problem reaction that causes everybody to be soft on those issues that have morally destroyed, those moral issues that have managed to destroy every culture that has embraced them in history. We are the first people so well informed, at least we allegedly, who have embraced and adopted the ills that have wiped out every single culture. And I see this problem reaction solution as the way it's been brought upon us.
I think you're right. The creation of a false opposition, the concept of a socially acceptable rebellion, that's everywhere, and I see it in but I want to say that when you read Hegel's philosophy of right, the primary unit of social life that informs everything else is the family.
Yes.
Both the nuclear family and the extended family. And now that family will eventually break up as the kids grow up and the parents die. Then they go off and they work in what is called civil society, or our day-to-day economic labor issues. However, the way Hegel views society, the legitimacy of the corporation, as I mentioned before, and the corporations is coming to form the state, is that we are prepared to accept these things as something along the lines of a much larger family. Mm-hmm. And they really come from that same source. It's not just a unity, but it's a unity that we can rationally see and justify as our own, because we speak the same language, we have the same interests, we have the same basic ethnic, cultural, and moral concepts, and that's where and only where solidarity comes from. So unless the state partakes somehow of our initial family when we were kids, it can't have legitimacy.
Well, gentlemen, I do thank you once again. Al, we'll see you back here next week. Matthew, we hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.